So what was it like to actually run an intelligence organization in Canada? Hi, this is Phil Gerstey, President and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting in Russell, Ontario, Canada. You're listening to Canadian Intelligence, eh? So as I've told you ad nauseum, I spent 3 decades in intelligence in Canada, both with CSE, Communication Security Establishment, the Signals Intelligence, and CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. But I was an analyst throughout that time on a variety of issues, foreign intelligence, security intelligence, et cetera. And I never really went more towards the managerial administrative side of the organization, only because I liked what I was doing. I remember when I was at CSE, if you ever try to get to the chief's office, that's what we call the head of the organization. It was on the second floor of the old Sir Leonard Tilley building in southern Ottawa, and it was the inner sanctum. And as a young analyst, you didn't dare broach the inner sanctum because it was so almost kind of holy to go there. And then when I worked for CSIS, starting in 2001, it was the sixth floor. And again, it was this series of offices run by the director and a bunch of deputy directors, et cetera, et cetera. And it had this sort of, I don't know, this air of not only a lot of importance, but a lot of very, very busy people. And you just didn't wander up there and have a chit-chat with the director of CSIS. But that's exactly what we're going to do today. I'm so thrilled to have on the podcast the Ward Elcock. He, of course, was the director of CSIS from 94 to 2004. He also was a deputy minister of national defense from 2004 to 2007. And he and I are going to talk about his years at CSIS and some of the challenges of running an intelligence organization. So, Ward, thanks so much for taking the time to come on the podcast.
It's a pleasure, Phil.
Let's start with the easy question, Ward. A lot of people talk about intelligence culture in a society. We here in Canada, of course, are a member of the Five Eyes, the UK, United States, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. As I've always said, the gold standard of intelligence sharing in the world. But what is it for a country and a government to actually possess an intelligence culture from your perspective?
I think it means that within government, I think to have an intelligence culture, there has to be some understanding outside of government as well. But to think of government alone, there clearly needs to be a sufficient cadre of people across government who understand intelligence, who know what it can and can't do. They will have differing levels of knowledge, but generally speaking, there will be a widespread understanding of intelligence and its abilities and how it is acquired and what it can and can't do.
Now, recently, there's been a lot of criticism of the Canadian government for perhaps not really having an intelligence culture. And I'm pointing, of course, to not just the allegations, but the intelligence from our former organization, CSIS, that, in fact, the People's Republic of China had interfered in our last two elections at the federal level, 2019-2021, that intelligence wasn't received, it wasn't passed up the line, it wasn't read, it wasn't paid attention to. This is an unfair question, perhaps, to ask of you, Ward. And I know that you've left the business in 04 or 07 from National Defense. I've been gone since 2015. Do you think we in Canada, generally speaking, have as robust and mature an intelligence culture as, let's say, the Americans and the Brits? And I'd even throw the Australians in there.
I'm not sure that I would compare Canada with the States or with Britain. I think they both have much more highly developed cultures, and are the long term engagement in intelligence. A better comparison, I think, is probably with Australia. We're a similar sized country,
right?
And with relatively similar interests and backgrounds and so on. Compared to the Australians, I don't think we do. We're never going to get to the level of the Americans, but I don't think we rise to the level of the Australians. And I think partly that has to do with the reality that Canadians, unlike Australians, tend not to see threats to their well-being. I think the reality of Canada is that we see ourselves protected by three oceans and the United States to the south. Right. We have not endured any major terrorist acts. In truth, mm-hmm. We're not subject to military threats. right. in reality. And I think that tends to mean that Canadians are not much interested in national security issues, which means you're not really interested in intelligence particularly, or defense issues. And politicians are intelligent, and they know when voters care more about healthcare and and other issues, and don't care that much about national security, that they shouldn't spend a whole lot of time on national security.
You raise an interesting point, Ward, about, you know, the fact that's true. We haven't had a major terrorist attack on our soil. I mean, obviously, the Air India attack was planned by Canadian Sikh terrorists and killed mostly Canadians, but it happened off the coast of Ireland. So a lot of people say, well, it didn't really happen in Canada. But when you talk about, you know, threats to our defense, you and I, of course, are from an era, you know, we grew up during the Cold War. When I worked, started at CSC in 83, everything was about the Cold War. It was all about, you know, the Soviet Union and its ability to fire cruise missiles across the North Pole into Canada, United States. Have we, would you say, looking back, that given that there was, let's face it, an existential threat during the, you know, mutually assured destruction of the Cold War, that we had at one point a better intelligence culture, and that's kind of waned over the years?
I think we had a better appreciation of threats, but at that point, our intelligence part, well, we CSE existed at that point in time, and then RCMP, National Security Service, existed at that point in time,
right.
Not CSIS. So whether or not our intelligence culture was, I think on balance, leaving those issues aside, I think I'd say it probably was better in those days, that there was a better perception of the potential threats to Canada and therefore more interest in intelligence. I mean, one of the things that strikes me, frankly, as an example of that is foreign affairs. I mean, I think in that period, there were a number of people in foreign affairs, fairly senior folks, who had a broader understanding of intelligence and its utility and its importance. And when I look at external affairs more recently, frankly, I don't see a department that's particularly interested in intelligence per se. People, the intelligence side of foreign affairs tends to be a kind of add-on, poor stepchild. I think it may be changing a bit. They may be attracting some better people into that side of the department. Mm-hmm. But the last X number of years, it to me has been an example of where an understanding of intelligence has gone down rather than retained what existed during the Cold War.
You and I are obviously biased. You know, you were the director of CSIS, as I spent 3 decades in Sikh and Inhuman. So clearly, we thought intelligence was important. That's why we went to work every day, is to try to produce the best intelligence possible, to pass it up to senior officials, to enable them to make better decisions and policies. Does it bother you? And you rightfully also point out that most Canadians don't care, because we don't face the threats that you alluded to earlier. It's not the same as housing. It's not the same as healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. Our biases aside, does it bother you, though, that Canada's intelligence culture is as weak as it is right now?
Oh yeah, it does. I mean, I think that it is for us an inadequacy that we probably need to fix. The issue of how you fix it is the bigger question.
Right.
Frankly, I think a number of us who came out of the business in an earlier day, we probably would have retired to our cottages and probably never talked to the news media again. I think a lot more people who were engaged in the intelligence business and so on are talking to the media, are providing information to people. And I guess it's always been my hope that the more it got discussed, these issues got discussed, perhaps people would become more interested. But so far, I haven't seen that's happened, frankly, which is unfortunate. But it does kind of sometimes leave you with the feeling that barring some major crisis that forces us to pay more attention, it's unlikely to change much.
Isn't that really human nature, though, that it takes something absolutely catastrophic? I mean, people would say, look at what 9/11 did. I mean, not that the Americans didn't have an intelligence culture prior to 9/11. They clearly did. But you look at, you know, look at 9/11, you look at Pearl Harbor, it really concentrates the minds. Is it the unfortunate nature of the way humans act that it really would take something of that level for us here in Canada to understand this and appreciate it more?
Yes, but it's unfortunate. And you would hope that, frankly, having seen what has happened to some of our allies over the years, that we might have learned our lessons earlier and might not need a direct catastrophe in Canada, affecting Canada, to actually learn the lessons ourselves.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, of course, Ward, has come up, especially in the past 48 to 70, 72 hours, is this notion of an intelligence failure. Everybody's pointing at the Israelis, and you've dealt with the Israelis. I've dealt with the Israelis. They were, very competent internal service, external service, military intelligence. They had the Gaza Strip wired up 9 ways to Sunday. I'm sure that Hamas was penetrated by Israeli human sources. And yet you had this catastrophic attack that began Saturday morning. I'm hearing casualty counts now of over 1,000 Israelis have been killed in the past 3 days. And as we were talking earlier, before we started recording, about, what's Israel's response going to be. How do you react to this notion that it was truly an intelligence failure on the part of the Israeli services? Is that a fair accusation to make? Or I've always liked to say, those of us that work in intelligence are only as good as our last failure. Nobody really cares when we get it right, but they certainly want to point fingers in our direction when we get it wrong. I'm not asking you this as an Israeli specialist, but what is your reaction when you hear words like intelligence failure being thrown about with respect to major events like this?
Oh, I think my definition, and probably your definition, of intelligence failure is different from that of the news media and others who report on it and point the fingers. The reality is that I think for any intelligence agency, it's always in some sense a failure not to provide information on an event before it happens.
Right.
But the reality of life is that intelligence is not a certainty.
Right.
Nobody is omniscient in the intelligence business. Nobody has all the sources that are necessary to provide all of the information all of the time. It's simply not, it doesn't work that way. Often getting intelligence is a long and very complicated task, and it's possible to miss. A real intelligence failure that I would feel, where I would feel the fingers were fairly pointed, would be where we had received the intelligence and had ignored it or had entirely misinterpreted something that was obviously was obvious to anybody else.
Right.
That would be an unfortunate, a really unfortunate intelligence failure. An intelligence failure where you simply have not been able to find the information. It happens. And unfortunately, intelligence is not omniscience. It will happen. What happened in this case, I guess, is yet to be determined.
Right. I think you do put out a fair point, and I think in this case, especially, many people look at the Israelis as sort of the, the stars of the intelligence world.
The gold standard.
Yeah, they're very good at what they do because they have to because of the existential threats on their borders. And exactly. I think the assumption amongst Israelis and other people is that Israel was so good that their intelligence was omniscient almost or as close to as possible that this thing simply couldn't happen. And if it did happen, then clearly something went wrong. The other thing, Ward, I want to sort of touch upon with you, you were the director of CSIS through a very interesting time. So you assumed the directorship in 94. Now, so 94 is a few years after the Cold War has ended, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, major changes to the way that the security service. So by the time you took over, it was 10 years since the dissolution of the RSB security service and the creation of CSIS. A very different mandate in the 80s where the foreign espionage and foreign interference was sort of the soup du jour. That was our number one threat. And it kind of morphed into, a bit of this, a bit of that. Terrorism started to be a little more important in the late 90s. And of course, you were the director during 9/11. Can you walk us through what that transition period was like while you were director of CSIS?
Yeah, it was kind of an interesting period. There was a short period right at the beginning of my term where in some respects, it looked like intelligence was no longer going to be relevant. I mean, the Soviet Union had collapsed. the KGB didn't know who to report to at home, or the folks in the mission here didn't know who to report to or what to provide. Chinese were an irritant, but and we knew they were there, but not a huge, not what they are today.
And they were the Soviet Union, yeah.
And terrorism was there. I mean, the Sikhs had bombed Air India, so clearly terrorism was an issue. But there was a period when it looked like the world was going to be at peace forever, and intelligence wouldn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
But that was a really very short period, and the terrorism really became the bread and butter of the service, I think, fairly quickly.
Right.
And unfortunately, I think what's happened now is that terrorism has not gone away. It still has to be the bread and butter of the service, because there are a lot of Al-Qaeda and ISIS are still out there, as well as other organizations. But the reality is there are now foreign interference, or the activities of foreign intelligence services in Canada has now popped up as a major issue.
Again, yeah. So, you know, this, again, you know, you're not there anymore, I'm not there anymore, but it seems that, as you said, we've had these sort of ebb and flow of threats that have taken the attention of the intelligence services over time. If you were to, you know, miraculously find yourself as the director of CSIS again in October of 2023, what do you think the challenges are? I mean, as you said, you've got a number of threats that were seen to have, at least some interpreted, had sort of gone by the wayside. I mean, hell, I remember being in Moscow for a G8 meeting with Russian intelligence services to talk counterterrorism. I mean, we thought they were on our side back then in the post-9/11 period. What would it be like to run an intelligence service today where, as you said, terrorism has not gone away? The Islamists are still dominant on a global scale. And there's a lot of talk about the far right. I talk about the far left, and maybe they're going to rise one day. You've got foreign intelligence services. You've got foreign interference. Would it be almost, I'm not going to say impossible, but the challenges must be tremendous to try to run an intelligence service and keep your eyes and ears open to all these threats simultaneously?
I think that's a challenge, and I do worry that CSIS may not, in fact, be funded to do it. And I also worry about another factor, which is our tendency in this country, partly because we really don't see the threats. We tend to see the threat as being from the intelligence service rather than from all the targets that the intelligence service should be targeting. Mm-hmm. So we tend to see that we tend to over-regulate, review our intelligence agencies, in particular CSIS. Mm-hmm. I mean, essentially, you have almost three organizations reviewing the service at this point.
Yes,
I mean you have the parliamentary committee, not parliamentary committee, but the committee of parliamentarians. You have the review agency, and then you have the federal court, which has turned itself into a sort of pseudo review agency on a pretty thin legal framework. So that I worry about a lot, because I think that's enormously onerous for the service to deal with. But budgets and that are, frankly, probably the biggest issues on the director's table at any particular point in time. All the intelligence issues you have to deal with are the complication.
You know, it's funny you mentioned oversight. I think, if memory serves me correct, if you look at the CSIS Act, I think only one third of the CSIS Act discusses what the service can do, and two thirds discusses what it can't do in the sense of oversight bodies. And is this uniquely Canadian, Ward? I mean, is this the typical apologetic, sorry, a Canadian, that we want to make sure our intelligence services don't overstep their bounds? Or is this something that was put in place way back in 84 when it was created out of the old security service, that people were nervous about having a civilian security service that was, you know, we don't want a CIA here in Canada or an MI6, where people really sort of, we want to put in place as many barriers as possible because we don't want this service to do things that Canadians wouldn't accept?
I think it was not, I think what was done in 1984 was not unreasonable. And frankly, in a couple of cases, the fact that the review agency existed and could review the service's activities was it beneficial for the service. Mm-hmm. I can think of more than one case where during even my time, the fact that we could, in some sense, get the good housekeeping seal of approval from the review agency was actually really important to the operations of the service. Okay. So I don't think that review was necessarily a problem. I think we've gone overboard with review to create another committee of parliamentarians with no rationalization between those two committees. Right. And then to let the federal court do what it has done. And unfortunately, it's not a strong court at the best of times. So I think it has done some damage. Mm-hmm. I think that is the unfortunate part, not the fact that of review. I think review was inevitable, but I think we have allowed it to go overboard. And I think in part that's because, as I said earlier, I think we worry more about what the service might do in Canada than we have worried about what the threats are and who are the perpetrators of those threats.
That's a really good way of putting it. Last question, Ward. You know, as you were the director of the service for 10 years, how would you, you know, what would you like Canadians to know about the CSIS for which you were responsible for that decade? What should Canadians realize about the women and men that worked at, you know, under your directorship at CSIS? What do you want Canadians to take away from that?
I think, frankly, and CSIS was still a relatively young organization when I became the director, but it had been around for long enough to begin to develop a personality as an organization. Those were 10 very good years. The people in CSIS were highly capable and well-trained. The organization had, for the time, and better in some respects than many other organizations, highly skilled technological capabilities. Mm-hmm. So it was an impressive place to work, where people actually wanted to do a good job and saw their job as being, if you will, a bulwark for the country. It was a good organization. I have no reason to think that that has changed, but I do think it's probably a little overburdened at this point in time. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because, you know, as I say to people, I consider myself very fortunate as a Canadian to have been asked to work in intelligence and do a job where I thought what we were doing was important. We were providing information to succession of governments to help them make better decisions. And if it helps at all, Ward, everyone I talk to says, you were the best damn director we ever had at CSIS. I'm not trying to blow smoke up your backside, but I think it really was a tremendous period of time in Canadian history. As you said, morphing from the Cold War into a sort of the war on terrorism after the attacks of 9/11. And the organization is still one that is outfitted by some very talented Canadians who, as I've said, go to work each day with one thing and one thing in mind only, and that's to help keep Canadians safe and keep us safe from threats. So thank you for your service to Canada, sir, both with CSIS and with National Defence. And thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks very much, Phil. It was a pleasure.
That was my conversation with Ward Elcock, who was director of CSIS from 1994 to 2004. What do you think about his views on intelligence culture and the role of CSIS in helping to keep Canada safe? Love to hear your feedback. You can reach me on email, borealisrisk@gmail.com, or on Twitter at borealissaves. You can also find me on LinkedIn and on Facebook. If you like the content, want to subscribe, go to the website, borealisthreatmiss.com. Hit the subscribe button. It's free of charge. All the podcasts and blogs are there for your perusal. I'd love to hear your feedback, maybe ideas for further topics. Talk to you again soon. Until then, take care.